afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon.
Go right ahead.
Doctors, I thank all of you. Many thanks to the healthcare workers in Barbados. Now, Dr. Bass, you are reported as describing the phase of the virus as a smoldering epidemic. I understood what you meant. I felt that the article could have explained to Barbadians in greater detail exactly what you're saying. Now, my question is, and it's to any of the doctors who are still on the line, do you think that there needs to be a more concentrated campaign focusing on the various communities where we see the distribution of leaflets, flyers, whatever, going into each household so that people will remain cautious and careful to avoid a second spread or second outbreak of this coronavirus?
So let me thank the caller for that intervention and for the question. So I did say that we have a smoldering epidemic, and I said that in the context of what we had anticipated before the start of our epidemic. So before our very first case, nearly 2 months ago, we had done some modeling exercises with colleagues from the University of the West Indies. And what they had painted in the scenario, if we did absolutely nothing, we would have had an exponential rise of cases, and our health systems would have been overwhelmed. That, of course, is the absolute worst-case scenario if you do absolutely nothing. By a smoldering epidemic, what I meant was we staved off the worst-case scenario. We did not have an exponential rise of cases. We did have a rise, which is turning out to be the first wave, and we were able to contain and we were able to bring down the rate of the rise of cases to a very manageable number, and that would have resulted in us making recommendations to the cabinet to say, look, this is what has happened so far for the first 3 weeks. We can therefore make some recommendations in terms of easing the lockdown, because the public health and social measures that we have implemented are not without a cost, as everyone could appreciate. So the caller would have suggested that perhaps it is time to have a concentrated campaign so we keep people remain vigilant, communities remain vigilant, and that is exactly what we are doing. Just because we have a smoldering epidemic does not mean that this is time that we can stop everything and return to normal. This epidemic is going to be with us for many months, if not longer, and it is going to require us, not only as a Ministry of Health and Wellness and as a government of Barbados, but all of Barbados, to remain vigilant in terms of what it is that we need to do. See, we will not get tired of repeating the messages of the non-pharmaceutical interventions. You would have heard them many times in the show so far, and I'm going to repeat them. That is physical distancing, maintaining a distance of at least 6 feet from persons, hand hygiene, so the use of soap and water to wash your hands, or the use of alcohol-based hand sanitizer, and respiratory hygiene. So for those persons who are sick and have respiratory symptoms, which are the most common set of symptoms with COVID-19, to practice good hygiene and seek medical care when required. So I like the suggestion, but it is a suggestion that we are already implementing in many different manners. So thank you.
Okay, great question. Dr. Bess, you're being taken to task here. And this person really says on the WhatsApp, my business too is classified as a food business and I sell in the market. So please, rather than a private call, please air this on the program. I sell fish cakes. What do I do? I have not worked for 8 weeks. And I think this is in reference to the gentleman whose WhatsApp I had read earlier. Yeah. So they just want to know what to do about this food business. And maybe if you can't, if we can, I don't know if we can somehow get Richard Carter, if he may be the better person in this particular case to answer this one. But I think in the interest of the public's concerns that we need to be able to answer this for those who are listening, who are involved in the food business. They really need to know if they can start or if they cannot start.
Sanka, I absolutely agree. Every single day we get calls in the Ministry of Health asking us questions like this, and we have to deflect the questions and direct the persons to call either the Prime Minister's office or the AG or another source for that kind of information. We get a lot of calls on the COVID hotline, but appreciate that our remit is mainly the public health and the medical aspects. And that's why I'm not in a position to give with absolute certainty any guidance to that question.
Okay. No, I'm just very, because we've heard the music, so we have to take a break for the latest within another minute. But I'll just leave this one with you. What are the current recommendations for persons who would have experienced the loss of taste or smell? Is there any medication that is being used for such conditions? So maybe we can look at that when we return. Dr. Ford or Dr. Bess?
Yeah, thank you. Let me respond to that.
Oh.
So Dr. Ford a few minutes ago would have explained that we relaxed the criteria for testing of COVID. Mm-hmm. And one of the key signs and symptoms is that loss of taste.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we a few weeks after the start of the pandemic, is something that became very prominent.
Okay.
And that is one of the signs that we have been paying very close attention to.
All right, Dr. Bess, I'll have to let you pick it up for here because we do have to break here for the latest. So please stand by, everyone. The latest follows. Welcome back to Brass Tacks. This is Sanka Price with you along with John Stout. We have on the line with us still the Acting Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Anton Bess. We have the Director of Medical Services at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Dr. Clyde Cave. And we have the Head of the Infections Prevention Control, and that would be Dr. Corey Ford. We also have Ms. Joanne Waterman, the President of the Nurses Association. How are you today, Ms. Waterman? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Sanka. Thank you very much. I'm happy to have this forum to voice on behalf of the nurses. I hope you are well, actually, and your family, and you're staying safe.
I certainly am.
We like to think of Brass Tacks as the people's court, and I expect an opportunity to speak for a few minutes. I want to say that other forum is very, very limited, very tight, and we can't expound on anything. So thank you so much for having me on.
All right. And of course, we have on the line too station manager and moderator, Mr. David Ellis. We are looking today at the situation with COVID-19 because it dominates everything within our society. And mostly we're going to look at what is happening from a medical perspective. And if we may just start back here with Dr. Bess, public service awareness clips that we play ask doctors to contact the hotline and to contact the authorities about, you know, if they see certain types of symptoms and whatnot. So have you been getting a lot of referrals from doctors?
Hey, Sanka.
Yes.
So around the 22nd of April, so about 3 weeks ago, we made a pretty significant change to our criteria for testing. So before the epidemic started in Barbados, we were focused on people with a certain set of symptoms. So for instance, if they had respiratory symptoms, including fever, and we were also looking for travel history. So you had to have a travel history to be considered a suspected case in a majority of cases. So our epidemic would have started on March 16th. And as you can imagine, as time went on, when you started to have imported cases that would have had local spread that are detected through contact tracing, and then the fear that there would be ongoing transmission, we had to broaden the criteria for testing. So we wanted to test more people to see if, in fact, the downward trends that we were seeing were not real, and just to make sure that there are not people out there with the virus that we're simply not detecting. So we relaxed all of the criteria, and I would have heard Dr. Ford mention this earlier. So what we would have done in collaboration with the Government Information Service is that we would have put out a series of PSAs explaining what it is that we're doing from the Ministry of Health and why. We would have also worked with organizations like BAM. In fact, they helped us to finalize our guidelines, and we would have then disseminated the finished product to their members and disseminated it to other doctors not represented by that organization. Essentially, we don't have any criteria for testing right now. If a doctor is seeing a patient or is aware of a patient and there is any suspicion whatsoever that it may be COVID-19, we've even set up a hotline where that doctor can call. We want a specific set of information, and the testing is done at Paragon in that circumstance. We've also opened up all of the polyclinics to be able to see persons who are suspected COVID-19 patients and for them to do swabbing of those persons who are suspected. So we've changed the criteria. Before the break, there was a question about anosmia, which is the loss of smell. And the question was asked about the treatment for the loss of smell. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware if there's any specific treatment for anosmia. My understanding of it is that it is a symptom. It is a symptom indicating something. In the COVID-19 era, it's a very important symptom because we are now recognizing that this is a common symptom of COVID-19. So it's not so much about the treatment of the symptom. It is the fact that this could indicate that the person possibly has COVID and needs to be tested. And, of course, if they tested and they're positive, then they would be isolated and treated appropriately. And that would also kick off contact tracing, etc.
Okay. And before we go to the phone lines, just want to ask one more question here. And this goes to the psychological aspect. This was touched on a lot by Dr. Ford as well. What is being put in train officially to help people who are coming out of being cured? So are you putting them in contact with the psychiatrist or the psychologist, or you're leaving it to them to do that on their own?
So what I would tell you is that from the start of the epidemic, we developed a protocol for the mental health of persons with COVID, as well as persons working on the front lines, because this is a very stressful time. And dealing with COVID, whether you're dealing with it from a quarantine perspective or dealing with it from an isolation perspective, and then all the other frontline workers, it is stressful, and mental health of staff, healthcare providers, persons working in facilities is very important. What I cannot say definitively is for the person who has left the isolation facility, if there's any follow-up plans in terms of dealing with their mental health. But certainly when they are in hospital, when they are in isolation, we do have protocols in place where a team from the psychiatric hospital can assess and can manage the persons with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, well, we have Ms. Waterman on the line, of course. So let's hear how the nurses are coping with COVID-19 in the hospital and outside of the hospital. Ms. Waterman, you have the floor.
Yes, good afternoon to everyone and to the public and the doctors there on the panel. I have to say before I begin, the intention was not to be on the panel with the doctors. I wanted to make a separate intervention. However, as you know, today is International Nurses Day, and it actually is a very momentous year of the Nurse and Midwife 2020. Because it's the bicentennial birth of the world-famous nurse Florence Nightingale. And we've had a whole week of celebrations, educational and otherwise. But what a time and year it has been with this scourge, I want to put it, of the coronavirus pandemic impacting us. We've already established that it's unprecedented. It's the most troubling period in our healthcare history. And nurses, of course, at the front line in caring for these patients. We want to know how it's impacting nurses. Nurses are the people 24/7 around the clock, the largest proportion of the healthcare service, and are working at great risk to themselves, like frontline and their families, plus their real physical demands of working the 12-hour shift. And, of course, because it's a national crisis, no vacation period, and these are very unusual times. So working really hard, long hours, the psychosocial, physical and psychosocial aspect of it, and, of course, the great risk to safety and health. So we are praying for the continued safety of our nurses. We salute our nurses as unsung nightingales who deserve to be justly rewarded. And I want to make a special statement outside of this with respect to what is happening, what we are advocating for, what our expectations are, and some other areas that I want to cover, please.
Okay. But the one of the things that we would like to look at is we would like you to tell us, based on the feedback from the, from your members, how do the nurses feel about the conditions under which they're working right now?
Okay,
at the
well,
QEH,
let me go straight to addressing
COVID-19 in
yes,
particular.
Okay. Now, while, and we have been updated by various sources, management, et cetera, at QEH, as well as the ministry and other senior personnel. Now, while we are satisfied, while the nurses are satisfied with the level of protection that has been put in place for the non-COVID health environment, and having done that by having set up the quarantine centers, and that is the focus. However, the concern is that now that we have community spread, and as a matter of fact, by the time it reached stage three, we were shouting out there to advocate, okay, now you've had the emphasis on the frontline workers and the frontline institution settings, but now it's necessary to have the same kind of emphasis and protection for the nurse in the institutions. That is, well, of course, actually an emergency department has been considered frontline too, and it certainly is frontline because that's the front entrance to the hospital in terms of admissions. So we initially had problems at stage two where actually we had exposure unknown, and one of those patients died, to one of our nurses. And at that point in time, it was not clear-cut policy of what was happening because it was only suspected. So we were very distressed and disturbed by that. And the quarantine center, the safe haven for nurses, was not yet set up. So all of that meant that the young nurse who actually was exposed went back home to her family without having the quarantine period. And we pushed to get that quarantine period and the testing. Now, at that point, I know it was very fluid and things were moving rapidly, et cetera. But at that point in time, what we wanted to see, what we wanted to hear is that, look, we're not clear on everything that's happening right now, but based on the fact that this healthcare worker provider, nurse, is so important to our system, let's go ahead and test that person. Let's go ahead and quarantine that person. Let's go ahead and do whatever has to be done. Now, moving on from there, what we've had subsequently is, of course, now accident emergency and all frontline, we've been informed. It's been reinforced that they are well covered for protection. They now have the policy in place for, we've been told just a few days ago by the authorities that there is the approach for periodic testing of nurses. We want to know also if it's going to be mandatory testing for those nurses who would have become exposed now in the community spread, at psychiatry, at geriatrics, if the same policy now will be developed to expand, and it needs to expand to those areas so that we will have the same protections and same safety for those nurses in those institutions. In addition to that, not only that, but the geriatric hospital in particular, they're very dissatisfied right now, this nursing staff, because they have problems of not having access to basic items that will enable them to be safe. Things like gloves, soap, bleach. This might sound simple, but those are the things that you need for sanitizing. In addition to that, they have an ongoing sick building syndrome and the infrastructural problems, and the training for psychiatry, for all psychiatric staff, has not been completed, nor has it been completed for geriatrics. So while we laud the emergency operating team, our doctors, our nurses, the healthcare authorities, for having really put the efforts for stockpiling, for protection of the frontline workers, frontline nurses and essential workers, the same emphasis has not been, well, we know it would not be the same emphasis, but what we want to say is now you need to think, expand. understand, be proactive now with respect to community spread going into the other institutions.
Can I ask a question, please? David
yes.
Ellis?
Hello?
Given all that has been said about the retrofitting of Enmore, the surgeons have expressed their views on it. The nurses are seen as vulnerable as well. Do the nurses have any position on that, one way or the other?
Well, the nurses' position really would be one of, I heard Dr. Cave, I heard him when he spoke, and he put his position. And what I would want to say on behalf of nurses is, look, we need to protect the rest of Barbados. So if we're talking about setting up an environment that would be for COVID patients, we want to keep all the separations going. So we therefore would want to support the setting up of a surgical area that would be conducive, would certainly be the ideal for COVID patients being having intervention, intrusive procedures. Now, if it is possible within the safety protocols to at the same time, now we understand the other doctors, the other surgeons' positions, they need to have their continuing practice going on. But is it possible to have a level of protection going on, running simultaneously with that? Is that possible? And our all of our concerns will be within the protection and safety of our nurses, being the largest proportion, the beating heart of the healthcare system, to be there 24/7, to be exposed to whatever is going on. We want it to be such a structure. We will be supporting the position of keeping COVID-19 patients separate, period.
Are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. You finished?
With respect to responding to Mr. Ellis's question.
Oh, okay. We thought we had lost you there just now. Everything just went...
Yeah. But that's
you didn't hear all that I was saying?
Yes. You say that you wanted to keep... You support the idea of keeping them separate, which means there's still the question of what has been identified by Dr. Walren as the conditions up and more. While you want to make sure that there's a separation, and you have far more nurses in the QEH, in the mainstream QEH, than you would have at Enmore. But do you have any concerns at all about those who would be working at Enmore and the conditions there?
Yes, the concern, of course, is going to be that if there is any possibility of risk to our nurses, then we absolutely would not want them to be functioning within that environment. But as I said, when I listened to Dr. Cave, hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
When I listened to Dr. Cave's intervention with respect to how they went about determining Enmore as a place where they could set up the necessary invasive procedures with the negative pressures, the important key thing of the negative pressures and the total environment, then if the environment is such that it is protective of the healthcare workers, of which nursing being the largest part, then we will be satisfied with that. But if there are issues and there are concerns, or then of course we would want to have our nurses removed from that area.
But you don't sound as though you all were consulted on this.
Hello?
You don't sound as though the nurses had any consultation on it prior to what you heard from Dr. Cave today.
Well, listen to me. That's why what I want to put out a message today, too, that one of the concerns that we have, and I'm going to digress a bit here now, with respect to responding to your input of nurses into decision-making, there's a lack of understanding or refusal to acknowledge the professional nurses as being not just a group of persons doing a job in isolation, but being knowledgeable, intelligent persons who are part of an established body since 1800, the established body that was instituted by our world-famous nurse. And as a matter of fact, don't forget, she did teach doctors, and she did revolutionize public health. We've been struggling to be recognized and acknowledged as a professional body with substance from then until now. And, of course, we affiliate with the global international body that sets the standards for practice, leadership, and scholarship. So I want to stress that this year has been one in which we endorse the international body and that we affiliate in such a way that we have taken up programs as part, I'm going to your point, we've taken up programs as part of making the thrust for advancing the profession in the form of identifying young nurses.
Ms. Waterman, are you still there? I think she fell off the line. All right, we'll try to get back, Ms. Waterman. I think somehow the line went dead there. In the interim, Dr. Bess, are you still there with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. What we do? I'll just ask you this question here on the WhatsApp.
Sure.
This person is saying, back in November and December last year, many people contracted a viral illness and experienced many COVID-19-like symptoms. Those who were afflicted said it was like no flu they have ever experienced. This illness appeared to be highly contagious as it spread quickly through many offices and households. Could this have been COVID-19? And if it was not, what illness was it?
Yeah. Sanka, what I would tell you is that in many countries, a lot of people are realizing that COVID was actually around many weeks and in some cases months before the recognized start of the epidemic in their countries. And this is quite fascinating for us because it's making us question, you know, where did COVID really start? One of the things that we are yet to do, we've been meaning to do it for quite some time, is to look at respiratory samples that have been archived in the lab from as far back as January, take those samples out and to test them for COVID to see if, in fact, those samples on persons with severe acute respiratory illness could have been, in fact, COVID as opposed to something else. I'm not aware of the outbreak that person is referring to. The only way for us to be able to determine that is if biological samples were taken that the public health lab has. So I will certainly have a conversation with the public health lab to see how far back do samples go and if we should explore the possibility that we actually had COVID long before. I don't think it is likely, but there's no way of knowing until you investigate and do the necessary tests.
Because that is one of the questions that I have heard around people talking about this bad flu that existed sometime in November, December. While you're with us, because we just reached Ms. Waterman again, but since you're on, would you like to clarify the whole thing about the food? You said you wanted to clarify that.
Oh, right. So my apologies for not being able to respond to the two callers previously. They were specifically asking about the sale of food. In the emergency management COVID-19 curfew directive number 4, it is stated that restaurants for off-site delivery of food only would be permitted. So based on what was being described, I would dare say that is not in keeping with the law at this current point in time. Under this current directive, which expires on the 17th of May.
Mm-hmm. All right. So all those with listening would have heard that one. No food. Not selling no food. Not until May 17th. Let's go back to Ms. Waterman. Ms. Waterman?
Yes. Thank you, Fru.
Good. Somehow you ran away from us just now.
I'm not sure what happened there. It happens. Oh, okay. Well, I was responding to Mr. Ellis's point about whether or not there was any input from the nursing fraternity or nurses. Now, I cannot speak specifically to nursing management, what happened at QEH with respect. I would like to think that nurses had an input into whatever plans were going on for QEH. And I always want to think that nursing management is enabled an opportunity to make an input into all the other health settings, but we know that that is not the case. So hence, I was about to put something within the context of showing you what the problem really is, where it continues to be persistent, even in this year of the nurse and midwife, the momentous year. So what I was saying is that we have actually affiliated with the international body of International Council of Nurses. And what we've done for this year, in looking to how we can advance the profession, we have identified a group of young nurses, potential leaders, who can take the profession forward for its survival and sustainability. So we're developing a number of programs that would foster the growth and development of these young nurses. And therefore, we have a real passion and responsibility to advance our profession. But listen to what this. In trying to do that, what we get, not only problems of not being at the table in decision-making regarding healthcare settings and institutions, but with respect to the profession itself, what we get is a lot of pushback, attempts to retard the professional growth of these young individuals who are intelligent, highly qualified individual persons who have now gone through a four-year bachelor's program. Well, it was a three-year associate degree before. Nurses who are at master's level, who even have PhDs and very advanced in their practice, this presents a real problem for us. Because what happens when you continue to retard such a group? What happens? They become demotivated. And we lose them to greener pastures. And we will not stand for stifling, therefore, of the voices of our young nurses. We will no longer be standing for, we should never have been standing for in the first place, not having a seat at the table, because as they say, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably being eaten. So we have to move the profession to an advanced status, and this can only occur if all levels of nursing practice, nursing administration, nursing education are enabled to flourish. It must happen. Listen to me, we have a chief nurse, and that person, although working at the level of a ministry, within that structure, must be afforded the professional autonomy to assist with the development of his or her profession. Now, this lies the problem where the separation of understanding by career management and other officials who do not understand or refuse to acknowledge the difference between the working at the bedside, clinical practice, ongoing daily work compared to the professional body's advancement. They should be intertwined and almost one and the same. While on one end, management is pushing the daily clinical practice, the professional bodies have to push the professional status. And we do not get that recognition or understanding that that is what we're doing. Hey, look, the theme for today is a voice to lead, nursing the world to health. How very poignant and pertinent to the current environment. In order to achieve this, therefore, we need to have an environment that is safe to patients and nurses, and therefore we must have all the tools for the job so that not only are we advocating within the professional development, scholarship, et cetera, education, but we are advocating for the clinical aspect within this pandemic, and we have done so proactively, adhering to the WHO protocols, with respect to prevention and control of infection, advocating for all the personal protective equipment. And we've heard this over and over again, all the physical and psychosocial needs that our nurses need. And we've been told in a forum not so long ago, a couple of night evenings ago, that there is no shortage of PPEs. There are some other issues which we're trying to work through. So we are seeking to ensure that all, and of course, one of the very ticklish things right now, with respect to this environment for our nurses and nurses on the whole, frontline workers in particular, the periodic testing of nurses and then going on to the mandatory testing, the need for mandatory testing and quarantining, as I had highlighted before, of nurses who are likely to be exposed, that is a real issue that we need to address. And by that, we mean, therefore, looking, as I said before, to repeat myself, at the impact that it's having on the other institutions. So we are seeking to ensure that the tools for the job are in place for geriatric and psychiatric healthcare institutions as well.
Thank you very much. Thanka? Thank you very much for responding to the question.
You're welcome.
Yes, Thanka?
We'll take a commercial break here, and then we'll be right back, and we'll go to the phone lines when we come back.